Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Christoph Koch, who is the Lois and Victor Trendle Professor of Cognitive and Behavioral Biology at Caltech and the author most recently of The Quest for Consciousness. He is on the Berkeley campus to give the Forster Lecture on the Immortality of the Soul. Christoph, welcome to Berkeley.
Good morning, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
In the Midwest, in Kansas City, believe it or not.
Surprising. How did you happen to be in America for your birth?
I talk like our governor does.
That's right.
My parents were diplomats with the German State Department, so they happened to be in Kansas City because there turned out to be lots of Germans there who emigrated there after the war. Mm. So I moved around. I have a French baccalaureate, and then I lived in Morocco and in Holland and in Canada.
Mm-hmm. So a citizen of the world. Looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, since I moved every 3 years, I didn't have so many, you know, it's difficult to acquire long-term friends. So, I mean, everything was we are a very tight family. So all my intellectual upbringing and my desires, my passions, I have for my parents.
Mm-hmm. And when did you get the science bug, so to speak? What led you into science?
Well, I mean, from age 9 or 10, I wanted to be a zoologist. I wanted to be a zoo director and a zoologist. And then somewhere at age 13 or 14, I wanted to be a physicist. And then I studied physics. And I guess shows you the importance of role models. I grew up reading books about, you know, Einstein and Heisenberg and Planck and all these physicists. That was terribly influential for me. And then when I would decide upon a university, well, I never really made a conscious decision. It was always clear I was going to go to university, study physics. Mm-hmm. That's what I did.
And when one looks at your degrees and the subject matter, you really have covered the gambit of the sciences. You have a French baccalaureate. You study physics and philosophy at Tübingen in Germany, and master in physics and a PhD in nonlinear information processing in the dendritic trees of arbitrary geometry.
That's correct.
So you science has come to you easily? I mean, there was a kind of a natural coming together with these different subjects, or did one set of problems lead you to another set of problems?
Well, both. I mean, I always wanted to be a scientist. I mean, at least from very early age on, I love science. I love the process of doing science. If I could, I'd like to know everything there is about the world, but of course you have to realize as you get older, you have to concentrate on one particular aspect of it. And so I chose to concentrate on the brain, how the brain processes information, in what way is it like a computer, in what way is it different from the computer. And then over the last 20 years on the problem of consciousness, possibly influenced because of the many philosophers I read.
Mm-hmm. Now help us understand, is it fair to call you a neurobiologist?
Is that?
Yes. So help us understand the skills and temperament required to do that kind of work before we talk about the work.
Well, I mean, it's different from being a physicist. So in some parts of science, like in physics, there are a few deep principles like general relativity or like electrodynamics, and then you can use a few principles to explain a large number of facts in the universe, like the cosmos and its evolution and how particles move inside the cosmos and how planets act and things like, and you know, why if I drop my keys, why do they fall to the floor, etc. Biology is a very different character. Biology, there are very few common principles, except maybe the theory of evolution. It's a gargantuan number of facts that you have to know and have to assemble. So you really have to be in the field a long time. So prodigies, children prodigy exist in maybe in mathematics or in music or maybe in some areas of theoretical physics, but don't exist in biology, because in biology you just have to know a huge number of facts, which of course takes time to acquire. Because, you know, each biological system is sort of an accident of evolution, and to understand it, you have to understand its unique circumstances and how this animal is different from this animal, and you have to just know molecular biology and biochemistry and neuroscience and psychology and a theory of evolution. So it requires a much larger number of facts to explain any given observation.
Mm-hmm. What about temperament? I know, looking at your website, that you are adventuresome, you're a mountain climber and so on. Is that just you personally, or what about the temperament of somebody doing this work that brings together so many fields?
Well, you have to love risk, which I guess is what you have to love doing if you like to do climb rocks or mountains. And you have to be in it for the long term. It takes a long time. You have to be very patient, and you have to love the process. You have to love the process because the action itself takes place over many years. You have to fight to get money to do the research. The research itself is very difficult. It's technically very demanding. It takes long, long hours. And then you have to fight to get it published and get it accepted by your peers. And so, you know, this can take 5, 6, 7 years for a single experiment to run through this entire life, you know, life cycle of one experiment. And so you really have to be passionate about it. You have to be passionate about the process and the rewards that are sort of very long-term, distant in the future. I mean, the objective rewards, like you get tenure or you get a good salary or something like that. So you have to do it because you love the act of thinking about and trying to understand a phenomenon, trying to collect data and sift through the data and try to find, you know, sort the chaff from the wheat and do things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that one of your main projects in the last few years is covered in this book, the quest for consciousness, a neurobiological approach. And what I first want to ask you is to talk about your collaboration with Francis Crick, because I know that the two of you working over a number of years helped came to define a kind of an intellectual framework. Talk a little about that intellectual process between the two of you.
Well, so Francis has that's the way he works. He never had a lab. He never worked with a large number of people. At any given point in time, he worked with one or two people, most famously, of course, with Jim Watson, and then also with Sidney Brenner, or with Graham Mitchison. And so we worked for close to almost 20 years. When I moved from MIT to Caltech in 86, we started to interact, and we met on a monthly basis to talk about the brain. And then in 1989, we started becoming very intensely interested because there was a certain neurobiological discovery. We became very interested in that. We thought maybe this would be the one of the critical features, a signature of consciousness in the brain. And I think what Francis appreciated about our interaction that the energy level, but also that the because he's such a well-known person, many people didn't really criticize any of his idea, and he didn't like that he wanted to be criticized. Mm. He was prodigious at throwing out ideas. Some were very smart, some were very perceptive, some were not so, some were just crazy. But you have this fantastic person, this creative genius who can just throw out these ideas, and he wants a sounding board to tell you, well, this isn't going to work. This is really great, but this is probably silly, and really have a give or take over many, many hours. I mean, that was his style of working, that you came in the morning and from 10 o'clock till 6 o'clock, you would just discuss papers, you would go through the evidence, you would sift the data, discuss it, look at it from different light, reject, have a hypothesis, reject it again, then dinner, and then usually after dinner, that process would continue. He kept this up till essentially the day he died.
Mm-hmm. And what we have here is we're on the threshold of a revolution in the biological sciences on the question of how the brain works and the biological basis of consciousness. So what in a way this collaboration was the formation of a kind of theory which could then be tested by empirical research. Is that fair? Is that a fair way to look at the article that resulted, which I guess you published in Science and Nature. Laying out an intellectual framework?
Yeah, it's unfortunately too ambitious to call it a theory. Yeah. It's a framework. And there's a difference. A theory, is something much more solid where you can make very specific predictions, like a theory of relativity. This is more a framework for approaching the problem in a way that allows you for a sustained research program, at the end of which you will understand much more about consciousness, and hopefully that's a hope right now, a fond hope, that ultimately you will solve the problem at the heart of the classical conceived mind-body problem,
mm-hmm.
namely how do feelings get into the world? How is it that the physical system, like your brain or my brain, can have feelings of pain, of pleasure, of being me, of being angry?
Mm-hmm. Now, help us understand, I think we know what consciousness is, or people think they do, but explain that. Now, I think you refer to Searle's definition, but help us kind of understand what it is that you're trying to characterize and then find the sources of that in the biology of the brain?
Well, yeah, so John Searle, you know, says that consciousness, what you have, when you wake up in the morning, you have it all day, and then it goes away when you go into deep sleep. And in dreams, of course, you also have it. So it's our ability, I mean, it's the most fundamental feature of the world. It's the way how we experience the world. When I feel pain or feel pleasure, I see you, or I'm angry, or I know I'm Christoph, I know I'm going to die. Those are all conscious sensations. Philosophers have the term qualia. So consciousness is made up of these different qualia. Qualia for being angry, for seeing red. And that is fundamentally the way how I experience the world. Is to experience the world means to be conscious of it. Turns out there are many things that I can do in my body. In fact, most of the things I do without having any conscious access to them. My digestive system works wonderful without me knowing about it. There are 100 million neurons roughly down here in your gut. 100 million. We're not conscious of them. When you run, when you climb, when you dance, when you drive a car, when you bike, you're doing things effortlessly. When you run down a mountain, you run very quickly, and you have no idea how you're doing it. You're doing it unconsciously. Mm-hmm. When I talk, it's not that there's a person, Christoph, in my head who sort of, you know, who puts these words together, mm-hmm. and then in German or in English, and the verb and the adjective, and sends it out. No, I have a vague idea, and the next thing I hear these words coming out of my mouth. So we know there are many things. In fact, the majority of things in my brain I don't have conscious access to. Certain things I do have conscious access to. Where's the difference? How is this possible?
Mm-hmm. And you actually refer to this as a kind of a zombie effect, namely not the consciousness, but these things that we do automatically.
Yeah, so we have all these zombies that we use all the time. In fact, life wouldn't be possible without these zombie agents in our head. And so this makes makes for an interesting research strategy, because I can now ask at the neurological level, at the brain level, where's the difference between those systems that mediate my zombie behaviors and those systems that actually require consciousness. And it's a scandal, and Francis always felt this, it's a scandal if science leaves out consciousness. You know, it's less today, but certainly 10 or 20 years ago when we started, many scientists, probably the majority, said, well, you know, consciousness, you've got to leave that to the religious people, you've got to leave that to the philosophers, you've got to leave that to the, you know, the new age crowd. That's not something scientists can study. But that's silly. I mean, we are conscious. As I argued, it's the most essential aspect of my life. It's the fact that I'm a conscious being. And if I leave that out, then I will forever deprive science of one of the key aspects of the natural world. We claim it's a natural phenomena. It exists, not here, but it seems to exist here. So science, if science has ambition that it wants to describe everything in this universe, then it has to describe consciousness. And otherwise, it's just a cop-out. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's difficult. It's different than trying to have a theory for how mass is derived, but it's nonetheless a natural phenomenon. We should study it as scientists.
Mm-hmm. Now, one is able to do the experimentation now. Why? Because of all of the new technologies that are coming on board that are allowing us to look at the brain?
Yeah, I mean, we can now do routinely in animals. We can monitor individual nerve cells. So you have to understand, if you want to understand chemistry, or if you want to understand physics, you need to know about atoms, and you need to know about molecules, and you need to know how they interact. And you can't do chemistry without knowing about molecules. Likewise, if you want to understand consciousness or perception or memory or thought and what happens if these goes wrong in mental diseases, you need to know about nerve cells, you need to know how they interact. And we today, in 2006, better than before in any point in history, we can monitor nerve cells, we can listen to them, mm-hmm. we can record them, we can stimulate them, we can do all sorts of things, both in animals mm-hmm. as well as in humans. In humans, it's much more difficult, of course, and we have brain imaging, which is cool, but it's a very low spatial resolution. But we have all these tools that enable us now to begin to monitor the brain at the appropriate level of resolution. And so now we think it's the time to start having experiments, and people are doing it, to study the neural basis of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And so then another challenge, I guess, is to devise the experiments to create reactions and then put this together, what we're now able to see? Is that the name of the game here?
Yeah, I mean, this is what scientists do, right? Try to do the right control, do the correct experiment, which, as I mentioned before, may take you many years, and mm-hmm. To figure out some fact about the brain basis of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Is there a thumbnail sketch of the brain that you could give a general audience that where the most exciting points of direction seem to be in your research?
Wait, you wanted some explanation of the brain? Let me rephrase it.
It's a bad question. In other words, basically, so let's begin talking about what your hypothesis is about how the brain works at this point of consciousness. What are the hypotheses that help give you an organizing sense of how to look for things?
Okay, so first of all, the overall approach that we advocate, that's now most people do this, is to study what people abbreviate as NCC, the neuronal correlates of consciousness. So those are the minimal brain state, minimal, because we know your entire brain is sufficient to give rise to consciousness. It does it each and every day. But for example, you really need your eyes to see. Mm-hmm. Well, I can dream, my eyes are closed, and I perfectly well dream, perfectly formed, you know, visual images. Mm-hmm. I can close my eyes and I can visualize. So I don't need my eyes. Do I need my cerebellum? Probably not for visual consciousness, or probably not for any consciousness. So you can ask these questions, what are the minimal set of mechanisms in your head that you need in order to be conscious? Is there a specific neural signature? Are there a specific type of neurons? Is there a particular type of neural activity? Are there particular types of molecules, particular types of synapses? Do they sit in a particular part of the brain? So you can ask this whole set of questions. And the name of the game is to try to isolate those mechanisms to really hone in, saying, okay, these neurons, in this particular configuration, we talk about collision of neurons. You have to imagine the brain is very, very, very large number. There are roughly, you know, 50 to 100 billion nerve cells. And each one is like a little computer. Neurons are not sort of dumb like a transistor. They're very, quote, smart. They're very sophisticated, each nerve cell, each neuron, and you have 100 billion of them. And consciousness may be a coalition of neurons. You know, it's a little bit like in a democracy when you have coalition that form and that assemble and then dissemble. Except the time scale is not years like in the American electoral system, but it's sort of a fraction of a second. And so for 100 milliseconds, you may have this coalition of 5 million neurons, and they make encode, they may give rise to, they may be the feeling of, darn it, I'm late today. And then this is suppressed because then there's this other 5 million neurons or 10 million neurons who now give rise to the, oh, I see my daughter over there. And, you know, then the fact that I'm late, you know, I forget that, you know, and I become conscious of my daughter. And those neurons in the brain represent my daughter. They fire and this now depends exactly on your philosophical predisposition. Some people say the firing of these neurons is identical to consciousness. Some people say, well, it correlates with consciousness. Those are the things that we don't know. But what we're trying to do empirically, where are those neurons? Can you track them? Can you catch a brief picture of them using some fancy imaging techniques? Can you influence them? Can you move from... See, as scientists, very often we can just observe. So, for example, functional brain imaging, I put you in a magnet, I show you faces, and I see every time you look at a face, this part of the brain lights up. People do that routinely. But now, so that's observation, that's correlation. What I would then like to do, I would like to move to causation, where I can influence. What happens if I can put a probe in your brain, like a neurosurgeon does during neurosurgery, and I can stimulate that particular part of the brain? Will you then see a face? Mm-hmm. And again, we can begin to do those experiments quite well in animals, and we can also do them in certain contexts, for example, in a neurosurgical context with humans, where I can move, where I can actually begin to intervene with the brain.
Mm-hmm. And you, as a matter of your strategy, are focusing not on all the different senses, but really perception. Tell us about that choice.
Yeah, we focus on vision, visual consciousness. So, you know, it's a little bit like the drunkard who lost his keys and then looks for his lost key where the lamp is. These are all very, very difficult problems. We haven't made that much progress over the last 2,000 years. So, you know, when you ask people consciousness, they say, oh, you mean self-consciousness. Yes, self-consciousness is one aspect of consciousness, but it's very difficult to study. The fact that I know I'm Christoph, I know I'm a son, I know I have children, etc. That's very difficult to study empirically because it's very difficult. It's unclear to what extent animals have consciousness. Some probably do, like the great apes, but it's very difficult to study that. So let's study a much simpler aspect of consciousness, namely red or blue or seeing motion or seeing a face. We can manipulate that very well. We can do what magicians do since hundreds of years. So if you go to a magic show, you look at the magician will make things disappear in front of your eyes. He does that partly by using attentional distraction. He has a beautiful bikini-clad assistant next to him and you'll be distracted. Although you're looking at him, you're actually paying attention to her. We can do something similar, less sexy, but we can do something similar in the lab where we can show you things that you routinely don't see. They're in front of your eyes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. So now we can use this technique to ask, well, in both cases, there's an image present on your eyes, but one case you were actually conscious of the image. In the other case, you were not conscious of the image. Where's the difference in your brain? Is there the area X, the consciousness area, that lights up? That's one hypothesis, that whenever this area lights up, well, you're conscious of it. Mm-hmm. Where is that area? Is it a series of stages? It's not going to be one area. We know that. It's going to be a series of areas, probably distributed, that have different properties. So we can do this in a magnet. We can put you in a magnet. We can show you these images that you see sometimes, sometimes you don't, and we can study that. And you can also do this in a monkey, or you can do it in a mouse. So vision has the advantage, visual perception, and we can manipulate your visual percept very precisely in space and time. We can't do that as well as for pain. Well, it's also very difficult to recruit people to do pain experiments.
Yeah, right.
It's very easy to recruit them to look at a monitor and, you know, we pay them $20 to do that. And so it's a tactical reason why we focus on visual perception.
Mm-hmm. And some of these experiments play with, for example, when these coalitions are often in competition, basically. Is that?
Yes, just like, again, so that's why I think the election or democratic analogy is very, or metaphor is very appropriate. You have all these neurons in your head, and they constantly compete. They excite and inhibit each other, and they constantly compete. And at any given point in time, there's only one dominant coalition. That reflects the character of your consciousness. By and large, you're only conscious of one or two things at any given point in time. You can shift rapidly, rapidly within a fraction of a second, but at any given point in time, you're usually only conscious of, let's say, one or two things. And so when you're conscious of one thing, something else is suppressed. And you can see that, for example, the phenomenon tip of the tongue, when you say, oh, what's that name? You know, and then you do something else, and 20 minutes later, it pops into your mind. That's exactly a case where the coalition of neurons that represent the name of this acquaintance you're trying to recall is suppressed by and by something else. Yeah. So you want to track this, and we have experiments in the lab where we do this very well. We have two different images. For example, we put one image in one eye and a different image in the other eye. And they compete. You only see one image at any given point in time, although they're both present. Let's say you put a picture of, you know, George Bush here, and you put a picture of John Kerry here, you will only see one of them at a time. It's called binocular rivalry. For 10 seconds, you may see Bush, and then there's a transition. You see Kerry for a couple of seconds, and again changes to Bush. So you have the two images, and the underlying neurons that represent them, they compete for attention. So you can use this paradigm to, again, to study the footprints of consciousness in the brain, in a human brain or in a monkey brain.
Right. And do the combination of these experiments over time, pursuing this framework, do you hope it will lead to a general picture that answers some of these specific questions?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Well, there's really no alternative, right? The consciousness is a difficult problem. We've thought about it. I mean, we as humanity have thought about it in the Western tradition, at least since 2,300 years, and the only way to approach it is in an empirical manner, step by step. You try to discover something about the material basis. Ultimately, of course, you need a theory of consciousness. You need not just the neural correlates, but you want to understand what type of systems, under what conditions, have conscious sensation. Because I'd like to know, for example, in principle, I'd like to know, what about a young baby that doesn't speak? What about a fetus? What about a patient who is in coma or who has persistent vegetative syndrome like Terry Schiavo? You know, I'd like to have a measure, and it's a real theoretical understanding. Is she not conscious? What about a monkey? What about a dog? What about a squid? What about a fly? Right now, we don't have a good theory, for example, for insects. You know, we accord consciousness really to the degree that other people are like us. And you can go back in history, right? People, you know, even the Greeks, they first thought, well, you know, the really only true humans are other Greeks, right? And the other one were barbaros, right? They were barbars. And we decided slowly, the last couple of thousand years, we decided, well, we'll extend this privilege of being real humans to women and to other people and to other races, and now we're beginning to extend this magic circle to other animals. That, yes, a monkey or a dog, yes, they don't speak, they're a little bit more furry, they look a little bit different, but their brain is very similar to your mind. If I give you a little bit of monkey brain or dog brain, or a little bit of human brain, it takes an expert to really tell the difference. The behavior is very similar, appropriately measured. So if a dog's in pain, that behavior is not that dissimilar to when you're in pain. You know, it yelps, it has high motor activity, you know, it wants to run away and hide, similar things to you do. Evolutionary continuity, all those reasons suggest that these animals are also conscious. They're not as conscious as we are. They don't know about Macintosh computers or things like that, but they certainly seem to have all the basic conscious sensation of pain and pleasure, and they can be depressed, they can be happy, they can be excited. now where does it end? What about a squid? And what about a bee? A bee is a very complicated organism. So finally, we need a theory that tells us which organism, including which artificial organism. At what point can you say, for example, say, if ever, that the internet is conscious? What about a robot? What about a computer? So we're finally, what we need is a theory that tells us which system under what condition will be conscious.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about this notion that one had in earlier periods of time of the notion of a little man,
basically,
yeah, homunculus in your head, making it. Is that? I mean, obviously there isn't a little man there, but is that a kind of hypothesis that one can work with, and you still try to use to because you're really talking about something that moves beyond the zombie effect, where you're responding. I believe you say you're responding to your present environment, but also it's related to the planning area. This is the point at which we need some entity, some unit, to be making choices.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a very compelling illusion, right? We all have it. There's a person actually sitting in my head. Mm-hmm. I can tell you where he sits here, right, roughly here. If you have one eye, I presume it would shift it over, and he's looking out at the world. We mm-hmm. all have this homunculus illusion. It's very compelling. So Francis Crickgen argued there has to be some neuronal basis for that to explain this very compelling feeling, and we have an explanation for that. But of course, as you point out, there is no homunculus. There's just a series of very complicated neural networks, and one network, you know, is looking at another network, and that's being looked at by another network. And ultimately, what you get out of this system, you get this feeling that there is a person sitting inside my head. But there's, of course, no point where you can say, well, see, that area, that's Christoph, right? Mm-hmm. That it's going to be, like most other things, a collection of neurons that do this process that ultimately give rise to this mysterious feeling, there's a person inside my head.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one of the images that struck me in the essay was the notion of that there were elements of the brain that are like a movie, essentially, or at least that could you help us understand that in other words, motion may come out of a series of images that are in your brain, and I presumably the images are an output of these coalitions of neurons. Help us get a handle on that.
All right, so there's this hypothesis. Is consciousness like a river, or is it more like a movie where you have, well, we all know we have the illusion of seeing life on the screen, but in fact, if you look closely, you know, there are 24 frames a second or 72 frames a second, and so you have a frame like this, the next frame like this, the next frame like this, but what you see, of course, is smooth motion. So psychologists have asked this question since a long time, and there's now some more evidence for it, that perception is actually discrete. It's actually organized in discrete snapshots. Each snapshot may be 30 milliseconds, 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, so a small fraction of a second. And each snapshot is a little bit like frozen, so it's like a drawing that you make of a, you know, like a runner like this. You know, clearly this drawing implies, you know, the person's moving forward, but the drawing itself is stationary, but it comes with the stationary drawing comes with a sense of motion. And there are this area that scientists have identified called MT. You have it on both sides of your brain, or sometimes called V5. It seems to be involved in motion. If you stimulate it, there's a sense of motion in animals. If you lose it, you lose the sense of motion. And the hypothesis is that these neurons in this part of the brain, that they encode motion in a series of these snapshots, and usually, just like in a movie, you're fooled by it. Although these are discrete snapshots, the world looks continuous. But there may be a rare condition, and the neurologist Oliver Sacks has described one of these, when, for example, he himself has had this condition under migraines, where this mechanism breaks down, and he describes this very vividly himself, and also explains some of his patients. When he sees, he says, well, the world appears shattered, atomized. What you see, I see the nurse comes towards me, and she's in this discrete stills. I don't see her smooth anymore. It's like a movie run mm-hmm. too slow. And so this world may be a manifestation of something that's more general, that maybe all of our perception is illusory. This smoothing, changing river of consciousness may actually be illusory in the sense that it's actually a discontinuous set of snapshots, but we don't experience this as mm-hmm. such. It would be another example of this perfect con job that's perception. There's so many things that are not really the way they seem, mm-hmm. but our brain suggests them, mm-hmm. and our brain is very good at that.
And is it is the case that the brain will often substitute information where there is no information? I mean, will it fill
yes.
in frames? Yeah.
Well, for instance, blind spot. I mean, if I close my eye, we well known, at least since the 15th century, there's a, you know, you can all find it here, roughly here, when there's a spot called the blind spot, when there's no information, there are no photoreceptors there, because that in that location, the wires leave the eye. And so at that location, there's no visual information. It's like you take your camera, your video camera, or your consumer camera, and some of the pixels are black. They would always be black, and you would immediately send it back, right? Well, why don't we complain? Well, it turns out there's a mechanism in the brain that compensates for. Mm-hmm. So I don't see a hole. I sort of have to test it by seeing, well, okay, somewhere around here my finger disappears. It does, again, it's a con job. It fills in the information. There's no information there, but it cleverly fills it in. And there are many, many cases like that where the brain fills it in, usually using appropriate stimuli. Mm-hmm. Because it learned over, you know, over the course of evolution, it makes sense. On average, it makes sense. But if you test it carefully, you can see there is a lot of this filling constantly going on. And even at the high level, at the cognitive level, I constantly make implicit assumptions about people, about their behavior, and I do it all the time unconsciously. It's just another example of the brain filling in and predicting things that are missing or predicting things into the future. Mm-hmm. That's what our brain does.
Now, in addition to designing experiments, I guess pathologies and disease are a fruitful place to look, where this comes out in Oliver Sacks' essays in the New York Review. Talk a little about that, because they offer the possibility of the breakdown of the systems and then a testing of the map of the mind at that time.
Yeah, so probably one of the most richest sources, the most fertile sources of information about consciousness is, of course, humans, because we can talk about it. And so there you have to go to the clinic, where you see a lot of sometimes bizarre conditions, but that really tell you a lot about consciousness. So, for example, prosopagnosia, you're unable to see a face. So the patient says, well, I can see, and there are different forms of it. I can see your mouth, I can see your eyes, mm-hmm. and I can see your ears, so I know there's got to be a face because I know intellectually they go together, but I actually don't see it. And it turns out you have a particular, very often, a particular part of the brain is destroyed. That tells us a really important point. It tells us consciousness, at least for faces, is localized. It's not global, distributed, holistic, gestalt-like, as a lot of people think. In this case, there's actually a discrete foci. There are a bunch of neurons that code for faces, that code for the conscious perception of the faces. If you lose them, you're unable to see faces. You can still think about them abstractly, but you can't see a face anymore. Another very important discovery was done at Caltech by Roger Sperry, based again on brains that don't work very well, namely epileptic seizures. And sometimes to prevent seizures from going from a small attack, from a so-called focal attack into a grand mal attack, you know, where people thrash around, you cut 200 million fibers connecting the left brain and the right brain. And then what they then did, what they then realized, that you actually have two consciousness, two minds in one skull. You have the left hemisphere, usually, by and large, that talks. That's usually the linguistic competent one. The right one can sing. The right one can grunt. The right one can answer simple questions, but it's not very sophisticated, but it seems to be conscious. So now you really have the dilemma. You have two people, in a sense, two conscious entity inside this one skull. It's a really interesting discovery. We work with patients. We work with a neurosurgeon, Dr. Fried at UCLA, again, with epileptic patients, where we can record for many days from individual nerve cells, something you can never do in a human otherwise. You can discover very interesting nerve cells in the brain of these patients. So again, the clinic has been one of the most fecund sources of information about the brain and about consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the insights that you draw on perception potentially could lead to insights that are actually relevant for the other areas of consciousness, smell, and so forth. Is that the hope here?
Yeah, it's just like in molecular biology, Harry. It's just like in molecular biology, where people argued early on, like Max Delbrück, for example, who said, well, let's study phages. Phages are these viruses that prey upon bacteria, and let's study the genetics there. And some people argue, well, that's so remote from human genetics, it's not going to tell us anything. Well, it turned out it's the same mechanism. It's RNA and DNA and proteins, the same mechanism. So here the assumption is, it's a hypothesis, maybe wrong, the hypothesis is that consciousness is something biological. It evolved, we don't know when, 100, 200 million years ago, who knows. But it's something that probably first came with consciousness for simple things like pain and pleasure. And then then evolution discovered it's a great thing. We think the function is to plan. And then it probably used the same mechanism for visual consciousness, for olfactory consciousness, and later on in more complicated animals like great apes and like dolphins and ultimately like us, also for self-consciousness, knowing who I am and projecting myself in the future, going through different scenarios. If there's an earthquake here, which door did I come in? Which door should I try to egress? So yes, it is a common that all these different forms of consciousness have something common. They have this subjective consciousness common, but they also will have or may have something common at the neurobiological base. That they're all caused by a similar set of neural mechanisms. That's the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. As I listen to you, I want to understand how you are confident in amidst this complexity that you're describing, because there's an interesting synergy here. You're saying you want to focus on a piece of the action, but the level of complexity is striking, because it's not just perception ultimately you're talking about past and present and so on. Talk a little about that, because that must bring the excitement of that you get in mountain climbing. Is there any comparability there?
Well, in a sense, it's daunting. I mean, you do often, you know, it's just like in climbing. What do you do when you have a difficult climb? You don't think about the 20 pitches ahead of you that are going to take you, you know, 12 hours. You just think, right now, mm-hmm. I'm on this pitch, and this is the crux that's coming out, and you totally empty your mind. You just try to solve this problem. And same thing here, if you think about the brain, it's so daunting. I mean, right now, there are probably on the order of 50,000 neuroscientists on the planet studying. Mm-hmm. 50,000 people study the brain. Each day, you know, there's just, you know, there, you know, each week there's almost a new journal in neuroscience and related fields that appear. So you can be totally daunted by it. So you have to focus and believe that ultimately, maybe similar to replication and DNA and RNA, translation, etc., there is a simple mechanism at the root of consciousness that humans are able to understand. There's no guarantee, right? It may well be that consciousness requires a brain, you know, even in principle, beyond our brain. I mean, some philosophers made the argument, well, what chance does an ant have of understanding relativity? There's nothing fundamentally it couldn't understand, but it just doesn't have the cognitive apparatus. Likewise, we may not have the cognitive apparatus to study consciousness. I don't like the argument. Of course, it's defeatist. I don't like it at all. I tend to be optimist. And I know for sure the only way to we will ever solve it is by trying to pursue this empirical route. So there's really no sane alternative.
Mm-hmm. I know that people like Searle believe that we're on the edge of finding these answers, that there's a real revolution and the next big questions are here and they will be, you know, answered in some reasonable time frame here. Why is this, that it's all coming together right now? Is it that these various disciplines are coming together? I mean, just looking at your own academic career and your training, that is all coming together among a community of scientists, but also with technology that can deliver things.
Yeah, fundamentally, like always in science, what's driving this is our instrumental ability, technology, that we can manipulate, we can study the brain at an unprecedented detail and resolution, we can begin to manipulate. That really makes all of this possible. Otherwise, we would just be sitting out and speculating. So that's the biggest drive of all of this. And then, yeah, they believe there's a conversion. There's a meeting now each year where philosophers and psychologists and neuroscientists come together, many hundreds of them, and talk about consciousness. So there's this great excitement that we are on the verge, or we're in this revolution. This is going to be one of the golden ages that people talk about in future histories, and we're well on the way to understand. Now, of course, one has to admit we may be fooling ourselves. You know, of course, it's always better to believe that you're going to solve the problem than to say, I'm not going to solve it anyhow. That's now how you do progress, right? So you could also consider this as a form of self-hypnosis. Right now, there's no question we're making unprecedented progress. We are beginning to intervene also in a therapeutical context with the human brain as never before. So right now, everything looks very positive. There's no question we will find the neuronal correlates of consciousness. There's very little doubt about that, assuming, you know, no major catastrophe in funding or other things. The big question is what a final theory of consciousness will look like, and will it really explain everything? Because some people say, well, you know, this is all very interesting, so I'm willing to believe in 50 years' time we know that if I feel red, then these neurons fire in this way, and if I feel pain, then those neurons fire. But so what? That really doesn't explain the feeling. Right, and people made very similar analogies with life. They said, well, you know, you're going to tell me it's all molecules and, you know, organic chemistry, but that really doesn't explain life. There's something magic about life. But of course, we discovered life is, you know, metabolism and hereditability, etc. And so likewise here, we have to see how far can we push the explanation, and will we finally have a satisfactory explanation of why certain types of system, namely us, some of the times, not when we're in deep sleep, not when we're in coma, have these in these states, and that's the open question.
Mm-hmm. Are there some subset of questions that are very important in the short term in this kind of long-term project that we hope to find the answers to that will be a piece of this?
Yeah, so that's why we focus on. People have criticized us focusing on the neural correlates of consciousness, the NCC. Well, you know, that doesn't really explain consciousness. So if you know these neurons are critical, so what? Well, A, that's something empirical project that everybody can agree we can actually do today with today's technology. And just like knowing the molecular correlates of heredity, once Crick and Watson saw, you know, the double helix, most of the problems were clear. Now, it's probably not going to be of this character for consciousness, but once and again, it shows that structure follows function, particularly in biological system. And once you know the structure, you're probably a huge step forward to understanding its function. You can also track that structure. You can track it in diseased people. You can, as I mentioned, in babies. You can track what happens if you've got schizophrenia, autism, or ADHD. You can track it in animals. So this will be a huge step forward. It will not be a final theory of consciousness, but it will be a gigantic step forward on the road to a final resolution of this mind-body problem. Of course, there are some philosophers who think this can never be done, right? There are some philosophers, David Chalmers for one, who argue there's the hard problem, the easy problem, that we scientists deal with the easy problem. He doesn't mean easy in the practical sense. He says the easy problem may take you hundreds of years to figure it out, the mechanism, you know, this neuron activating that neuron, inhibiting that neuron. But he said forever we'll be reduced to just saying, well, finally, it's just a list of bunch of material properties you can make in the brain. And over here you have, you know, things like blue and pain and being self-conscious, but how they link will forever elude us. But of course, many philosophers have before made the argument, you know, we shall never know what the stars are made out of, you know, we shall never know what life is, and so I'm very skeptical when philosophers tell me this is something in principle we can never know. We'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. What do you think will be the implications of this if you come up with an answer? In other words, does it have an impact on the treatment of disease? Does it have an impact on who we are and understanding
yes.
our place in the universe?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, certainly it's no question it will have an impact on disease, on understanding things like autism, schizophrenia. But more, even longer term, there will be, whatever the understanding will be. You see, we grew up with a picture in our history, in our culture, that we grew very fond of. And it remains to be seen to what extent this picture, you know, of people, independent actor, having free will and a soul and all of that corresponds to actual reality. And so we have to see how it pans out to be really know what we are and what's our place in the universe, and are we unique? Is consciousness unique to us? Are there, you know, what about animals? Right now we treat animals beastly, right? If you look at the way the animals are raised and kept in a horrible condition, you know, and for us to eat them, is that really justifiable, really? I mean, I don't think it is. And so once we realize, once we extend this magic circle of consciousness, once we're really compassionate about other creatures that can actually suffer and have a true understanding of that, and at the same time realize that certain people cannot suffer anymore, that a patient in PVS, in persistent vegetative syndrome, like Terry Schiavo, as far as we can tell from the best medical evidence, there isn't anything to suffer anymore. Right, there is, the person isn't dead because the body's still alive, but there's no consciousness whatsoever. Mm. So you could argue a person like that should be extended less, is sort of on the level of consciousness, much, much less conscious than any of our cats and dogs and pigs and cattle and veal that we treat horribly. Right, so all of this understanding will surely or is going to impact the way we deal with it. We treat each other and we treat the other creatures in the world. And then, of course, the question, should we create other conscious entities like computers? Is it a good thing? Will we increase the amount of suffering in the world? Should we do this? Under what conditions should we do this?
Mm-hmm. How does this work affect whatever religious or spiritual values you hold? Does it?
Yeah, of course. I think a lot about it. I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I think a lot about it. To what extent is this? I mean, certainly it's difficult to reconcile some of these ideas with the classical Roman Catholic doctrine of a freely independent actor. Right. I mean, this relates to the question we haven't talked about, to the question of free will and volition. But neuroscience, of course, like all of science, throws some doubts on that, some cold water on the idea that I can really truly act like the unmoved mover, the uncaused cause, right? Because how would that be? If I can truly act independent, that means that there's something happens without there being any something happening before. And how is that supposed to work in real life? So those are issues I'm profoundly and passionately interested in, to reconcile, to come to a single understanding of everything in the universe, including things outside the universe.
Looking to the future, if you had to advise students about how to prepare for the future in this field, what advice would you give them? I mean, obviously they need to learn this array of scientific skills that you acquired, but what about also humanistic values and education with regard to dealing with this once we come up with some of these answers?
Well, I mean, what I tell people who ask me what is they want to do is study physics, study math, study physics, biology, study the basic sciences, be compassionate, and leave the world a better place. There really isn't much else to much else to say.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, what about for the public? What is the best way to follow this revolution? They're obviously not going to go back and get graduate degrees and so on, but do you have some markers that
or they can read my book?
Yeah, right. And we'll show it again, right?
Well, I mean, there are now many, for example, Scientific American just started a journal called Mind last year, together with a normal Scientific American. They have this second journal, Scientific American Mind, that's just dedicated to the dissemination of a lot of these ideas. So there are many books being written, some very good books. Jordan Searle has written a wonderful little primer on consciousness and the mind. So there are a number of excellent books that are now available for the general public to inform themselves. The information is all there. I mean, it's not, you have to work at it. That's not surprising. Consciousness is this very puzzling thing, and it can't be reduced to a single soundbite, right? I mean, if you ask me what's consciousness in 30 seconds or less, it's difficult to answer that. But there are some wonderful books available that describe the current state of knowledge, incomplete as it is, for a general public.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, looking back at the trajectory of your life, what has brought? Are there some certain factors that have brought you to this? This focus in your life? I mean, does it all come together in a way in this, or is it primarily the science education that has led you here?
No, life is always a series of accident and then some more profound currents that tug you, that pull you along in a certain direction. So I've always had, partly because of my parents, the way my parents raised me in a very religious setting, I always thought a lot about some of these more fundamental problems about time, about eternity, about life before death and life after death. But it's always puzzled me that people are much more obsessed about life after death than life before death, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't it strange? People really, particularly in the context of consciousness, they rarely ask me, well, what does it tell you about life before death, and before birth? Where was I before I came into this planet? They're always obsessed about what happens after I go out. Anyhow, no, but so that certainly had a large influence, thinking about these big problems. I learned that the only way we can answer these problems in any satisfactory way is by doing science. I mean, it's great to do philosophy, you can think about it, everybody should do it, but ultimately you can't prove any of that. And so the only sure touchstone we have seems to me is this empirical knowledge. The rest, we just have to believe something.
Well, Christoph, on that note, I want to thank you for sharing your intellectual odyssey. And also for being patient as you with us for trying to get into this the complexity that you're working on. I want to show the audience your book again, The Quest for Consciousness, which I recommend highly. And I want to thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Harry. It was a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.